Accession number 30284, reel 6.
Renesmee, reel 6.
For debriefing, we reported to the intelligence people. There was a flight lieutenant on the squadron who was the intelligence officer. There was a squadron leader who was squadron leader Eddie Shackleton, who later became Lord Shackleton, who was the station intelligence officer. They were very affable to us, of course. We'd come in there feeling a bit weary, perhaps, after the operational flight. And it was always the same. We'd be given a mug of hot, sweet tea. We'd be given a cigarette. I didn't smoke very much in those days, but I did when I was on operations really start smoking. Not heavily. I never smoked heavily, and I gave it up eventually. But there was something in the relief of having the hot, sweet tea and having a cigarette to puff on. It did give you some relaxation. And we were debriefed. It was mainly the air observer who was debriefed, because we had to write a navigation log in the air. It wasn't well written. The aircraft was juddering about, and you were using pencil, and you couldn't keep the pencil on the paper much of the time. But at least it gave times and a brief description of what happened when you were flying. And that was the basis for the debriefing. After the debriefing, you usually went to the officer's mess or the sergeant's mess, and you were given a short meal. It was, if with any luck, egg and bacon. And that egg and bacon has stayed with me for the rest of my life. it meant that you'd survived another day. Egg and bacon has always been an attractive meal for me, and I still like it. Maybe I liked it beforehand. I think it was only one rash of bacon and one egg and some toast, but it was always meant that you survived an operational flight. And from then on, it was back to bed.
With the debrief, would they be after other information? I mean, obviously, you would have had your log and what you'd done and the timings of how it... But would they be after other information that you may have seen en route? Or?
Without doubt. They'd ask what you saw on the ground. And it wasn't usually the pilot who saw very much of the ground. It was the navigator in the nose sitting by the bomb site and directing the pilot onto the ground, who could see what was happening, and to some extent the rear gunner at the back. I'm going to go on a bit, because this time I'm talking about it didn't happen, but later on you could see all the flak which was coming up. It seemed to come straight at you and then sort of whip past the wings, and searchlights would come on you too. And gunner used to like firing down the searchlights. He reckoned it put the beams out, but he also was watching the ground too. So it was partly, and also the gunner was the chap who could see the bomb bursts and report the effect of them. So it was really the four of us together, but the wireless operator usually didn't see very much. The pilot didn't see a great deal. The navigator saw a lot, and the air gunner saw a fair amount, and we were the people who were debriefed and then sent back to our beds.
And what were you specifically looking for on the ground?
Well, I was specifically looking for the target. All our attacks, other than one which I will describe later, were at low level, and it was my job to give the directions to the pilot. It would be sort of target in sight, bombs fused, bomb selected, target in sight, left a bit, left, steady, right a bit, steady, so on, left again, steady. It would go on like that, and then as the target came in sight, so I would say, bomb's gone, bomb's going, bomb's gone. And then the bombs, the aircraft would jerk upwards a little bit. And I usually say, because I turn onto 270, and then it was up to the gunner to tell us about the effect of the bombs. The bombs, we dropped usually from 700 feet, and there was an 11-second delay. That meant, of course, that I couldn't see the explosion of the bombs from the front. The delay was because the if we had had instantaneous fuse, then the blasts would have damaged the aircraft itself. So we had this delay action, and we could still feel the jolt in the aircraft as the bombs went off, even after 11 seconds. They were fused, and as soon as they struck the ground, the firing pin set them off, and there was a big explosion. 2,000 pounds of bombs would make quite a hefty explosion. But there would usually be a fire to follow, and the navigator would note down how far you were from those fires. The gunner would report the fires, and usually about 25 miles away would be the distance from which the fires could be seen from the aircraft, from the gunner, from the mid-upper gunner. And I'd note that in my log, and that would always be given to the intelligence officer at debriefing. And anything which the gunner saw, he would see the explosion. He'd sometimes see things falling down, buildings falling down, so on, which he would report to, which I couldn't see.
In this early stage, though, were you actually involved in attacks when you were an oddball, or were you purely in the reconnaissance role?
No, the first attack I took was sometime later. I was crewed up, finally, on a fairly permanent base with a chap called Levin Raw. And the first attack we made was over Brest, and it wasn't at low level. It was at 10,000 feet. The German warships were in the harbour at the time, and the Brest was being heavily bombed, not only by us, but by Bomber Command. And we were given the task of dropping a landmine on the port. I can't remember the exact date this happened, but it's in my logbook. Anyway, we had this big landmine in the bomb bay. It was so big, it was 2,000 pounds, that the bomb doors couldn't close. It was fitted with a parachute, and that parachute was not to retard its descent, but to keep it upright in its descent. So it would actually fall at more or less the normal speed of 32 feet per second increase. And we were told to bomb at 10,000 feet. And we approached Brest, and I could see all this enormous amount of going on in front of us, explosions and flak going up and searchlights going up. And we had to fly literally into it at 10,000 feet. And I was pleased to find that I wasn't in the least deterred. I was just determined to do my job. And I could see the docks, I'm glad to say. And although we couldn't aim a landmine very accurately, I did drop it. With all the searchlights on us, and flak was bursting round us, and all that sort of thing. But we came through it okay. And the mid-upper gunner said it did explode somewhere in the dock area. I don't know what damage it did. There was so much going on in that port at the time that we were just one among many. But what happened was that we laid a course to go back home. By this time, I'd learnt my lesson. I didn't go direct. I always flew to the Scilly Islands. The Scilly Islands gave me a landmark. I could see them from the air. And from then on, we would go up past the north coast of Cornwall and cut into St Devil. There were cliffs at St Devil, and there was always a danger, incidentally, of sea mist covering the airfield. It used to, as you know, the weather used to roll in from the west, and it could cover the airfield. And it was one of the most dangerous things was, in fact, the possibility of crashing on the way back. It did happen, I think, to several of our aircraft. And you could only do that by flying fairly low, so you came in and saw the cliffs and landed, one hopes, safely. We did that on this occasion, but I was in the nose of the aircraft, packing up my gear, having landed, sat beside the pilot on landing, went in to pack up my gear. We had a navigation bag and all my instruments had to go in there, and navigation log and so forth. And to my amazement, there was a bomb exploded on the port side, then another one on the right side. It rocked the aircraft like hell. It sort of, God, I suddenly realised a blighter followed us in and dropped a stick of bombs right across us. So I ignored my navigation. I went back just in time to see the pilot's boots going out of the top hatch. And I did a very foolish thing then. I was so annoyed, I rushed down. There was nobody in the aircraft except myself. The others had all dived out of the aircraft and scarpered to the edge of the airfield. And I went in the turret and tried to move it round so I could fire at the aircraft. Of course, like an idiot, the power was off and I couldn't turn it round. I felt like an absolute idiot. But I was so annoyed at seeing these bombs explode, and I went to have a pot at this fellow. And this was it. And anyway, my pilot disappeared, and I think I came back somehow to the operations room, went back and got my kit, and began to talk about this, and the station commander was there, a chap called Rivington. I remember he pulled my flying suit open to look at my brevet to see who I was. The pilot came in late, and Levenroy came in late, and he got as far as these strange tubes which were around the edge of the airfield. He got as far as that. He didn't know what they were, and he was looking at them. Apparently they were just about to fire the things, but they didn't fire them. So I told him he very nearly got a rocket there, didn't he? Anyway, Levenroe and I flew for a few occasions, but he was a short service chap, and I think he'd flown on Beauforts, and he was nearing the end of his career. And anyway, he was posted away, and so I was back flying. I think I flew with the commanding officer on one occasion. We went out again to Brest, but the mist was covering the low stratus cloud was covering the ground, and we couldn't drop our bombs. Wing Commander Bauer I flew with once, and we had to come back again, which was a disappointment. He may not have been very pleased with me, but I literally couldn't see the target. I mean, it was stratus cloud over the ground, and it seemed futile to drop the bombs over cloud, and we brought them back again. And he was disappointed, I was disappointed, but that was one of the things I did. But then eventually what happened was that a newcomer arrived on the station. His name was Jack Percival. He was a flying officer, a Canadian. And I was appointed to his crew. He had come from operational training. And we had a wireless operator, a WAP AG he really was, called Davis, and a gunner called Reeves, Ken Reeves. Ken is still around, incidentally, and we talked to each other on the phone occasionally, exchanged Christmas cards and so on. He lives down the south coast. But anyway, we formed a crew, and I think a very effective crew. And we carried out numerous raids. The raids were on Brest, Lorient, San Jose and La Police, sometimes with bombs, and sometimes we dropped sea mines outside the entrances to the harbours. I think they could have been quite effective, those. They rested on the sea bottom and they were activated by vessels on top of going on top of them. I remember at one case off La Police, I could actually see the boys going into the entrance, and I dropped them smack in that. I thought that was a very effective one. And normally we drop them right outside the entrances if we could. I suppose they might have swept them up to some extent, but that's occasionally what we did, but more often we would have these low-level bombing attacks.
What did these sea mines look like?
It was more or less the same shape as the landmine. It went down by parachute, and I believe it stayed upright on the bottom. I'm not sure about that. But it was simply activated by the metal hull of a vessel travelling above it. And it would blow up, and if it was the water was shallow enough, as it would be outside the harbours, it would destroy them. With any luck, it would get a U-boat or something like that. These were U-boat ports, of course, that we were attacking, and it was a very difficult time of the war for us. I mean, it's true that in July, I think it was, Germany attacked Russia, so Russia was in the war, but America was not in the war, and we were well and truly fighting against the odds, and we were just doing our best. But anyway,
can you tell me about a little bit more about each of these specifically, these ports that you attacked, and how they differed, and which were the worst, which were easier, any kind of approaches you had to make?
Well, I suppose the most frequent one was Lorient, which was the main U-boat base. And our function was to attack the docks. We didn't attack the town. And in all cases, I could see the docks. And what happened was that we came in from the wrong direction, so to speak, towards the sea, and I could usually see these docks quite clearly and make an accurate attack on them. At the same time, there were houses, of course, on the right-hand side as we came in, and it's interesting perhaps to recollect that on some of those occasions, not early, but on the later occasions, particularly actually over Nantes, we saw V signs flashing at us. And you may remember that the broadcast made to Occupied France always started off with the V sign, di-di-di-da, di-di-di-da. And anyway, I only saw these on one occasion, but the gunner tended to see them, and we knew what they were. And they were civilians flashing V signs to us. And when I wrote them, they appeared in the newspaper. I've got the cutting still. And later, afterwards, when I wrote about this episode, somebody wrote to me, Jacques Elias, and he was a schoolboy, and he flashed the signs, and he was so pleased that somebody saw them. But we tried, of course, not to do any harm to the civilian buildings. We tried to aim purely at the docks, but of course it may have happened that slave labourers were in the docks, and unfortunately would have killed not just Germans, but people forced to work for them. But what could we do?
Would you have a specific area in the docks that you'd be looking to bomb? Would there be anything, or would it just be the general dockyard area?
Well, we dropped the bombs in a stick, not in a salvo. and the stick would travel over the whole of the docks, usually, not over the land portion of the docks, and that was the best we could do. The docks weren't all that big, and the stick would usually fall flat across them. It must have done some damage.
At that stage, was the fortified U-boat pens in any of these areas? Because I know I mentioned that they built
the fortified. They were not built at that stage. They were being built, and when they were attacked later on by Bomber Command with more powerful bombs than ours. No, the fortifications probably were being built, but they weren't all this heavily covered docks that existed down at San Jose and so on. No, this was in the period before that.
And what about the anti-aircraft fire? You mentioned that obviously it was heavy at Brest, but how heavy would you expect over port?
Well, it was light flak. It was two types. It was, I think, 7.62 millimetre, was it? Machine gun fire. It was 20 millimetre cannon fire. The lighter variety of machine gun fire looked like shoals of flying sparks coming towards you. The 20 millimetre looked like fiery golf balls coming towards you. But it's strange. It seemed to be coming straight at you and then disperse and go around the aircraft. And on no occasion on those attacks were we hit. I like to think it's because they couldn't draw a bead on us because we came in from the wrong direction. But perhaps I'm wrong. Perhaps we were just plain lucky, because we certainly lost a heck of a lot of aircraft. In the time I was in the squadron, we lost 24 aircraft. And if you consider that I suppose the most we could put in the air at any one time was about 8 or 9. Those were very, very heavy losses. And I know now that the casualty rate for Beauforts was at best 20%, at worst about 17.5%. The survival rate was no more than 20% for a full operational tour. I don't think all those who were lost were shot down. I think some of them crashed through other reasons, navigational errors or perhaps engine failure or something like that, but the majority of them were killed.
Did you ever discuss with other navigators how they approached the target?
Well, when I became the squadron navigation officer, I suggested to the others that they should do it. But I'm not too sure the pilots agreed with the system, because I meant circling around to some extent, getting behind them, and in effect lengthening the period of the operation. But with Percival, he thought it was right, because as soon as we came down, as soon as we finished the target, we could get down low, bang over the sea, get straight out to sea, away from... Whereas if we went in from the other direction, we would have to fly over enemy territory before we got down again. And I think he thought my system was correct.
And how long would you be really over the target area?
Well, I suppose over enemy territory we might be as much as 7 or 8 minutes. But over the target, only for a few seconds, but you could see it beforehand, 2 or 3 minutes beforehand, and the run-up, you'd start the run-up and start talking the pilot into it, maybe 30 or 40 seconds before you drop the bombs. And then, as I say, I go on to 270, and we get down low over the sea and get the hell out of it as quickly as we could.
Can you take me through a little bit again, Roy, just a kind of typical operation from what you would specifically do from the start of it to the finish of it? Is that possible?
I can read that information on something I wrote. We're about 12 minutes away from the coast. Pilot, what height do you reckon we are? Pilot, about 150 feet, maybe 200. Navigator, the ground's pretty low-lying around the target. If we're badly off track, it would be up to 500 feet. We don't want to hit a stuffed cloud. A stuffed cloud meant that it was stuffed full of hills. Pilot, climbing up to 700 feet. Keep your eyes spinning for night fighters, Reeves. Reeves was our gunner. Air gunner, watching out, sir. Nothing in sight so far. Navigator, ETA at San Jose, 2354. But we should see the coast in about 5 minutes. I reckon visibility is about 6 miles. Pilot, I think I see something ahead. What's that over to the right? Navigator, I see it. Cloud, maybe. No, it's a line of surf. But I can't tell where we are at the moment. I was expecting to see land off the port bow. Pilot, looks like the tip of a peninsula or an island. Navigator, there's land ahead about now. We'll see in between those two points, trying to identify a map. Navigator, I think we've got it. Let's land to starboard on the tip of an island called Noirmoutier. We're heading towards a peninsula jutting out on the south bank of the Loire estuary. San Nazaire's on the north bank. We're about 7 miles south of our track and 3 minutes early. I'm going to work out a new course. Pilot, keep that navigator's light dim, Nesbitt. Okay, I've worked navigator. I've worked it out now. Turn on to 031 degrees, magnetic. We should be over the target in 6 minutes. Pilot, turn on to 031 magnetic. Navigator, it's not a bad approach. We're flying towards the Loire estuary, and our ETA works out as planned. We were off course but ahead of time. But the ones cancel the other out. I can't see the pilot yet, the target yet. On the banks of the banks of the Loire are getting clearer, and I can map read easily. Air gunner. Searchlight starboard quarter, some distance away. Navigator, they must be the tip of Noirmoutier. We're travelling up towards them, travelling up away from them. Pilot, how long to target? Navigator, 4 minutes. I can see the north bank of the Loire quite clearly now, but I can't pick up San Nazaire yet. There are no lights and no flak. Pilot, good. Let me know when you see the target. Pilot, bomb doors open, height 700 feet. Navigator, bombs fused, bomb selected, 40-foot stick. We're too far to the right, left steady. About 2 minutes to go. Docks are quite clear now. Still too far to the right, left steady. Steady, right a bit, steady. Navigator, target almost in bomb sight. Right steady. Bombs going. Bombs gone! Navigator, turn to port, flak to starboard, try 270 degrees. Navigator, I think we're getting clear now. Keep flying 270 for a few minutes, and we'll turn to Cap Frail. Air gunner, there's still a searchlight almost on it. Shall I fire at it, sir? No, pilot, no, Reeves, you'll give our position away. Navigator, turn to 020 degrees magnetic. EDA Cap Frail, 0030, climb to 3,000 feet. Pilot, altering course, 0020, climbing to 3,000 feet. Any use?